You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
What we have issued is a sort of comprehensive and detailed report that really deals with the key federal privacy proposals and reflects an effort to go through line by line and make recommendations for a way forward that will deal with gaps in U.S. privacy legislation, as well as bridge the gaps in the privacy debate. This is an outgrowth of work that we have done dealing with a broad spectrum of stakeholders to figure out the key interests and to figure out some of the ways that these issues can be resolved. And in dealing with, in our discussions, people who followed the Brookings privacy debate may be familiar with the way that we have divided the issues. Based on the level of substantive and political complexity in addressing those issues, as well as the levels of agreement among stakeholders and experts, the key issues have been the endgame issues. But there are a lot of other hard issues dealing with how data is processed and some of the enforcement authorities. What we found in talking to a mixed group of stakeholders, both from civil society and from industry, was that there was a lot of agreement on many of the issues, but that the real sticking points are in preemption and private right of action. That's why we called them the endgame issues. So we started an effort to try to resolve those, but in the process to deal with all of the other issues that really determine the level of protection, because you cannot have the discussion about the endgame issues without knowing what is in the rest of a privacy bill. So ultimately, that is the effort that we undertook in dealing with really everything from those issues of preemption and private right of action on to the title of the bill and effective dates. But I want to just outline a little bit briefly how we've dealt with some of the key issues. So in preemption, we have a body of state laws, from state constitutions to lots of privacy laws, and to simply preempt the field would wipe a lot of that away. And it's hard to take rights and protections away from people. So, but by the same token, we need a consistent national standard so that businesses can apply the same standard everywhere. And so the consumers, individuals, can rely on the same set of protections regardless of where they are or much as possible, what kind of data is involved. So the standard that we propose is to preempt laws that address collection, processing, sharing, security of covered data to the extent that those are inconsistent with a federal law. With the FTC having the ability also to preempt in specific situations, to preserve a lot of the state laws that I talked about. And to add to that, a partial sunset after 8 years. This is something that was done in the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And you know, that would provide the opportunity to revisit the functioning of the law after 8 years. It worked as a compromise then. It may work again. So let me talk a little about private right of action. The key interests that we heard from there are, you know, the need for people to have some remedy for the kinds of injuries that have been protected by state privacy laws, by other laws. And that, you know, most people clearly recognize as real privacy injuries, non-consensual porn, financial losses as a result of a data breach. And, you know, also to make sure that, you know, bad actors don't get a free pass, that have some boundaries there. On the other side of the equation was the concern about exposure for, you know, pretty what some people refer to as gotcha lawsuits, ratcheting up through damages multipliers. So the ways that we've dealt with that are to provide that in most cases, recovery is limited to actual damages plus costs and attorney's fees, unless there are willful or repeated violations. That's the bad actors, in which event you could have statutory damages. And we also propose different standards of liability. So it's something called the duty of care, which gets at those core injuries that I talked about that would, you know, would be specified in a law along the lines of what's in Senator Cantwell's harmful data uses provision in her bill. And then beyond that duty, other broad duties, we have a duty of loyalty, which we'll talk about, and other provisions that have a direct impact on how much privacy protection people get, a knowing or reckless standard, and other provisions that are really sort of more administrative and technical would be a willful or repeated standard again. And in addition to that, we would create some procedural filters, in particular, an opportunity to cure, notice an opportunity to cure, which is tied to an individual right, an additional individual right that we propose should be part of a law, an individual right to recourse. This would require that before people bring suit, they exercise that right. And when you file the suit, you've got to attest that you've done that and attest to the standard of liability. Also, limits on class action based on existing law, the 1995 Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, you know, as much as possible, trying to follow laws that have been enacted before. And also providing that the federal remedy is exclusive, so you can't go around the damages limits or the liability standards by attaching a state claim. The duties of loyalty and care, duty of care, really, as I say, takes off from Senator Cantwell's harmful data uses. But we add to that that, you know, it's a duty to avoid reasonably foreseeable harms of the kinds that are identified. And we would add to those harms discrimination that violates federal laws or state laws to the extent they apply to a covered entity. So this is getting at basic privacy protections. And then a broader duty of loyalty that embodies some of the limits on collection and use that are in the existing bills, and that really embodies what you often see in privacy policies, the statement that we want to be good stewards of data. This is to put some meat on those bones and, you know, make that really a core part of the approach to regulation here. So, you know, what we've done is to, you know, try to really add to the trade-off between preemption and private right of action, a trade-off between some strong duties, but flexible duties, but, you know, duties that have objective standards, they're, you know, not defined by what a company puts in a privacy policy, and duties that have some teeth to them in terms of enforcement and of legal exposure. So we will have an opportunity for questions about this and about other aspects of the law, but I want to, you know, we'll take those after the panel. We do have some of your questions that people have submitted online. I'm hopeful that, you know, some of what I've said answered some of those questions. Certainly a recurring question was, you know, how do we bridge the gaps on private right of action and on preemption? We hope our report provides some answers and can help to get a conversation going on the path forward. So let's now move to explore that path forward with our panelists. So let me go in alphabetical order. So to first introduce Julie Brill, well known to people as a former commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission for 6 years, and now vice president and chief privacy officer and deputy general counsel at Microsoft. And since Microsoft is a generous donor to the Brookings Institution in general, I do want to acknowledge that, appreciate the support that it provides to Brookings programs across the board. I, you know, also want to disclose that I'm part of a Microsoft advisory board. Next in alphabetical order, we have Chris Lewis, who is the president of Public Knowledge, an advocacy organization that focuses on technology issue and protection of consumers and competition. And finally, we have Christine Wilson, who has been a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission since September of 2018. Has had a career before that as a competition lawyer at the FTC in private practice in-house. So welcome to all of you, and thank you for being here today. So for starters, you know, I want to sort of talk about the times that we're in. This is, we are doing this online. This is the first time that I've worn a necktie since the 11th of March, when I went to, you know, what was deemed essential travel at Brookings to go and talk to people on Capitol Hill about this project. And, you know, then I came away surprisingly optimistic that we could move forward on federal privacy legislation. Let me ask our panelists sort of the question that I've asked myself number of times over these past weeks as we've been preparing this report is, these times today, is this relevant? You know, what relevance does privacy legislation have when we have an economic crisis, a health crisis, social issues roiling? So, Christine Wilson, let me start with you.
Sure, absolutely. So thank you to Cam and to Brookings and to my fellow panelists. I think it's going to be a great discussion. And thank you also, Cam, for sharing your vision of what sensible privacy legislation could look like. So I would say that the need for federal privacy legislation is greater now than it has been before. There have been bipartisan calls for federal privacy legislation for many years, and there's a consensus from stakeholders that it is a good and necessary thing for a variety of reasons. The pandemic, I think, has laid bare in very stark ways the lack of federal privacy legislation that we have in the United States today, comprehensive baseline federal privacy legislation. We have new and complex and sticky questions about location data and health data. Obviously, both of those bodies of data are very sensitive. And I think if we had federal privacy legislation in place previously, it could have provided useful guardrails for addressing these issues for companies, for researchers, for the government. The bills and drafts that have been circulated over the last several months, I think, would have provided useful guardrails. And I think, generally speaking, it's important to emphasize that federal privacy legislation will provide businesses with the predictability and the certainty they need. It will provide consumers with transparency about how their data is being collected, used, shared, monetized. And I think the pandemic has further heightened the understanding that sectoral laws like HIPAA have gaps that are growing. And so all of those are very important considerations. And then we layer in constitutional considerations like the Fifth Amendment. And there is a reasonable expectation of privacy test that gets applied in Fifth Amendment cases. And if consumers have no expectation that any of their data will remain protected, then under the standard that exists in Fourth Amendment cases today, the Fourth Amendment gets eviscerated. And so I think for all of these reasons, the pandemic has further heightened the demand for federal privacy legislation. And Cam, I thank you for putting out a draft bill in the hopes of renewing this call and restarting this dialogue.
Great. Julie.
Sure. So let me also thank you. And thank you, Brookings, for inviting me to this really interesting event and especially one that's happening at a very interesting time. Data is going to need to be used in order to help solve the COVID crisis and to bring society back together. It's going to need to be used in multiple ways, finding cures, finding treatments, helping to mitigate the disease when it erupts again. And as a result, privacy is going to be more relevant now than it has ever been. We need to ensure not just that people will use the technologies that we're going to try to offer them in order to help mitigate diseases, mitigate the continued outbreak of the disease, but also we need to ensure that people trust these systems because they know that their data, if it is going to be used, will only be used for public health purposes. This is a core aspect of privacy. It's known as purpose limitation. We can't have a system, especially now when we see that certain vulnerable communities have been impacted by this disease much more than the general population. Black and African American communities, Latino communities, and the elderly have been hurt by this disease much more than many, many other groups. And these communities need to understand and need to trust not only that they can use these technologies to help them because they need more help than anyone needs, but also that the data will not start to be used by government, by law enforcement, by people who want to figure out who's showing up at protests, and for all sorts of other purposes. We need to ensure that privacy and this very important principle of purpose limitation is a really critical part in this context of the civil rights that individuals need to be ensured that will be protected as we move forward in trying to use data to try to solve some of the problems with respect to COVID. I also want to just point out really quickly, this is not a new issue. That is, that we need to ensure that the data is not used in a discriminatory way that harms vulnerable communities. This is an issue that the FTC was talking about 6 years ago when we did a report called Big Data, a Tool for Inclusion or Exclusion. And spoiler alert, for those of you who haven't read that report, we found that it can be a tool for exclusion and it can harm vulnerable communities. And one of the things that is deeply hopeful, not just in the COVID legislation that is being introduced and offered on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers of Congress, but also with respect to broad privacy legislation that has now been discussed for several months, if not several years, in Congress. Almost all of these proposals, whether in Senate Commerce Committee or House Energy and Commerce Committee or elsewhere, they're all including important provisions around civil rights and discrimination and ensuring that discrimination will not happen when sensitive data is used. Companies need these guardrails, and people need to trust that they can use use these apps, use these tools, and that the data that is collected is only going to be used for public health purposes. If we don't do that, and we don't do that quickly, we will not be able to solve this crisis.
Thanks, Julie. So let me go to you now, Chris. The relevance in this environment.
Sure, and thank you, Kim, for inviting me to participate in this panel. I agree with what Julian and Christine said about the importance of privacy at this time. For me, it always starts with a word that Julie used: trust. Technology is in everyone's lives in so many different ways. It's not just on your mobile device, but it's in all sorts of tools that you wear, in places that you go, in the ways that locations are tracking your information, companies are tracking your information, and the government's tracking your information. And so it's critically important. And up to this point, the admirable work that folks like Julie did when she was at the FTC, the work that Christine's been looking at, has been limited by the rules and the powers of the FTC to really engender trust from the public. The proposals that are coming out now over the last several months, this effort that you've put together, Cam, are really about raising the standards and raising, in my mind, the authority and the power of the federal government at the Federal Trade Commission or elsewhere to make sure that we can keep up with the pace of technology changes as it's moving into different parts of our lives. And with that, ensure the public that there is someone that you can trust in, that we're no longer asking for permission or asking for companies to change their policies to be in line with our values, but we have someone whose job it is to represent our values and to enforce certain practices and rules. So it's critically important. I think your proposal that you've put together here is a major piece, but only a piece of the work that has to be done around privacy. This deals with largely consumer privacy, but Julie brought up concerns about surveillance, which is related. Certainly, the conversation about dominant digital platforms is ongoing. And so there's so much work to be done. But privacy, I think, is, while it hasn't moved through Congress yet, the hard work that people have been doing, the hard work that policymakers have been doing to really learn about the possibilities for legislation, I think is well spent, so that when we do this big piece, which is the consumer privacy piece, that we that, you know, we take that really one important first shot at it and get a lot of it right. So, I think it's critically important. I also agree with a lot of what Christine said about the COVID crisis. This is an opportunity that if we can't move something large right now and comprehensive around consumer privacy, to look at the needs of the COVID crisis and help to shape the value so that the public understands where we're going with privacy in the future. There are proposals out there now, of course, that are targeted at contact tracing and health apps and things like that that are so critically important at this moment in time. So I'm optimistic about the work.
Yeah. Well, thanks. But, you know, we are seeing, at least in the COVID bills that came out before this week, some of the same divides over preemption, over private rights, right of action. And we saw that as well in Washington, Washington State, where there was a state bill that was, you know, a pretty thoughtful bill. Julie, I know you and Microsoft put a lot of work into that effort. And I think there were sort of high expectations for Washington State on, you know, sort of both sides of the debate, if you can characterize this as having sides. So let me start with you. What do you think are the lessons that we should draw for Washington, D.C. from the experience in Washington State?
Sure. Thank you. It has been a very interesting conversation in Washington State. I don't expect the conversation is nearly over. There were three lessons. There are three lessons that I think we can draw from the Washington State experience and the Washington State conversation that will be relevant, I think, for people in other states as well as in Washington, D.C. The first lesson is how much agreement there was among the various stakeholders on the core elements of what is required in a broad-based privacy law. There were... Everybody seemed to agree that there were four elements that are required in a privacy law. And there was a lot of agreement around even the details of these elements. There needs to be consumer empowerment. Consumers need to control their own data. There needs to be transparency so consumers understand what is happening to their data. In addition to having these consumer controls and consumer-oriented elements of transparency, companies also needed to, and it was recognized by all the stakeholders, companies need to accept and really embrace the fact that they have their own responsibilities for ensuring that data is used in a responsible way. And so these elements around accountability, around duties on the part of companies, something that your proposal talks about, Cam, very much were part of the conversation in Washington State. And then finally, there was a lot of agreement that there needs to be strong enforcement. The details, of course, on that mattered. And that was something where we worked and reached some compromises, but were not able to get over the finish line. And I'll talk about that in a second. But I think the second important lesson before we get to this issue about private rights of action and strong enforcement and all of that. The second lesson from Washington State is people need to feel protected. People want laws in place to protect their privacy and to ensure that when companies are using people's data, that companies are doing that in a responsible way. And if Congress doesn't act, the states will act. That is, nature abhors a vacuum. People need protection. And so there will be activity in this space. So I think that's a very important lesson two that came out of Washington State. And one of the remarkable things that you're seeing, not just in Washington State, but now in California, is there's more and more convergence around building laws that touch on all four of those pillars that I mentioned: consumer empowerment, good and strong transparency, company accountability and responsibility, and strong enforcement. Okay, the last lesson, I think, is that a state doesn't have to really think about preemption so much, but with respect to enforcement and consumer redress, I think the third lesson is this is not a zero-sum game. It's not all or nothing. That there's lots of room to talk about what it means to have strong enforcement and to ensure that people can effectuate their rights. I think most everybody agreed that consumers need some form of redress. It's their data. If something bad happens to it, they need to be able to seek redress. There was a lot of conversation about how we could get to a place where all the stakeholders felt comfortable. Frankly, I think if we had another month, we probably would have gotten there. It was a short session. But I think we shouldn't lose sight of these really important lessons that came out of Washington State, and particularly on this last point, that we're not in a zero-sum game. And there's lots of important conversations that need to happen about what do the stakeholders on the different that are bringing different points of view to the debate, both about preemption and about a private right of action, what are their interests? What are they trying to protect? What are they trying to achieve? And most importantly, what do people need? What do consumers need? So we can address their needs too.
Well, thanks. I hope that our report can provide some answers to some of that path on consumer redress. But Chris, let me turn to you and get your thoughts on what you see as the lessons in Washington State or other states in Washington.
Sure. I mean, first of all, I agree with Julie on the point about zero sum game. And I say that with representing an organization that that has strongly fought for a private right of action. But I think one of the things we learned in the Washington debate is that when it is zero sum, it's hard to get to a compromise that actually implements protections. And so, there's a hard line drawn around private right of action where your proposal includes it, and I'm happy about that. It may not be as strong as all the consumer advocates like us may want, but it includes some flexibility in how you get there. I think a second lesson I would highlight to go along with what Julie said is the importance of the law not being static, that it's not set in stone. We're seeing this in California, where, California responded to the demand of the public that Julie was talking about. The demand was so strong that California moved before anyone else to create a strong regime. It was criticized by many on different sides and for different reasons. But they're in a space now where they are looking at reforms, and we'll see how that process and that debate goes. I think the federal level can learn from that. We can learn from that when we pass a privacy law, if we empower the federal government to continue to move at the speed of technology with a strong regulatory authority and strong rulemaking authority, you can make those adjustments over time. Make up for mistakes that you may have made in crafting a law.
Thanks. So I do want to move to some of the audience questions that we have shortly, but I think there's one important question I do want to make sure that we get to. And Julie alluded to that, talking about civil rights in the context of privacy legislation. I think it's important that we have that conversation, given events of recent days. And I think it's one of the important aspects of what we propose. I alluded to including in the duty of care, duty of non-discrimination. We also have a civil rights provision that takes what Senator Wicker did, giving the FTC a role in at least collecting information and referring cases to federal agencies. and what Senator Cantwell has done to give the FTC some role in actually policing discriminatory data uses. And we've added to that, because the problems of dealing with algorithms, proposed a proposal for a disparate impact test. You need that with algorithms, because otherwise there's no way to get to the bottom of the analysis. But we recognize that this is a challenge for in the sense it's outside the traditional role of the FTC. And something really relatively new as a privacy issue, but ultimately conclude that using personal information in ways that's discriminatory implicates a lot of the stewardship concerns that we want to underscore. I want to explore that a little bit with each one of you, but let me start with you, Christine, in terms of how you see the FTC role. Julie alluded to work was done in examining the issue in 2016 and their proposals to have the FTC do reports. So what do you see as the FTC role? What do you need to carry out that role? Christine, you got to unmute.
Sorry about that. I was saying, thank you for raising the topic. This is a critically important topic for us as the nation is grieving over the murder of George Floyd. Obviously, discrimination in any way, shape, or form is morally repugnant. Personally, I believe God created every man and every woman in his image. We are all precious and beloved in his sight. And while the FTC is not a civil rights agency, the FTC actually has authority to enforce the law with civil rights and anti-discrimination provisions already. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act prohibits credit discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, age, or because a person receives public assistance. And the FTC recently settled with a car dealership and a general manager in the Bronx to resolve allegations of discrimination against minority customers, which is a violation of ECOA. The management in that case specifically instructed their salespeople to charge higher interest rates and to add phony inflated charges to the invoices of people of color. They said, don't try this with the Caucasians, but do this with the people of color. And so we brought a case there. And as Julie mentioned, the FTC did a report on big data and highlighted possible risks that could come from biases or inaccuracies in big data that end up resulting in discrimination or exclusion. The report also presented some policy questions to help committees determine how to use big data while limiting possible ethical or fairness harms. And the truth is, AI and machine learning are new frontiers for us. Tech is developing new infrastructures and economies, and we need to be sure that these new forms of technology do not facilitate discrimination. The director for the Bureau of Consumer Protection, Andrew Smith, actually drawing on past work like the Big Data Report and the Data Broker Report, continued the FTC's tradition of releasing guidance to combat discrimination very recently. In his AI guidance, he outlined how companies can use AI technology in a fair and non-discriminatory manner. He outlined the principles, the key principles that companies should ensure that the use of AI is transparent, explainable, fair, and empirically sound. He encouraged companies to foster accountability, especially by asking questions upfront to avoid risks of bias or other harms, including how representative is your data set? Does your model account for biases? How accurate are your predictions based on big data? And does your reliance on big data raise ethical or fairness concerns? So I will flows where I began, which is to say the FTC obviously traditionally is not a civil rights agency, but these things do factor into the FTC's work.
Yeah, Chris, let me ask you in terms of what Christine called novel issues, and certainly the privacy debate has really been sort of trying to process how this fits in. So, what do you think?
Well, like Christine said, this is a timely question because as we're all thinking about and concerned about whether there's going to be prosecution in the murder of George Floyd. I'm reminded, I'm not a civil rights expert, but I'm reminded of the calls that have come in the last few days about making sure we're using all the full extent of the law, so that they're not just filing for suit, with murder charges, but they're also looking at the patterns and practices of the police department. And that's an example in what I've seen on the news, the civil rights context of, the Justice Department being able to come in and investigate with their powers, the local prosecutors, so that we get a full picture and justice is served. Similarly, we want to make sure in the privacy context that we are not undermining with any new privacy laws, the powers to protect civil rights and other at other agencies or in specific sectors. And so that's what I like about your proposal. We certainly, public knowledge, we supported and praised the civil rights section of the Senate Democrat bill introduced by Ms. Cantwell that had very strong language power given to the FTC, non-discriminatory language across many intersectionalities, and that is strong. I think yours, your version may not be as explicitly strong, but it takes into account the concerns of other agencies and make sure that we don't take away tools at our disposal to fight discrimination. The FTC has a role to play. I think the commissioner explained that well, but it does not have all the powers that we need to protect civil rights. And so it's important that we preserve those and that the privacy laws and the civil rights laws can work together.
The wrong way. Julie, Microsoft has done a lot of work. Obviously, you're a leader in AI, but you've also done an AI ethics framework and been very involved in this discussion. Tell us a little bit about that and how you see that playing into the public policy discussion and particularly in the context of privacy legislation.
Sure, thanks. First of all, I think it's really important to recognize that privacy is a civil right. Privacy is a fundamental and indeed sort of a foundational right that individuals have. In Europe, they call it a human right. I think we can call it a human right, we can call it a foundational right, a fundamental right, but it is a right that needs to be protected. And as I mentioned before, there's such a close connection between the ways in which data can be used and the way data can be abused that I think the traditional concerns around discrimination and harming certain communities with the way data is used is deeply related to privacy and deeply related to these notions around making sure that you're using data only for the purpose that it's supposed to be used. Having said that, it is also important to ensure that as you're using AI, as you're engaged in sort of more advanced use of data, that there are principles in place. And, until laws are passed, and I want to put a pin in that and come back to that because Washington State actually did enact a very important privacy law in the facial recognition space just this past session. But in the absence of a broader law dealing with responsible AI, companies need to develop their own principles. And we have done that at Microsoft. We have a standard that we use and where we measure all of our AI against. And the standard requires not just security and privacy and safety, of course, which are deeply important, but also this standard includes fairness and inclusion. And those are the two principles that really get at discrimination. Are the AI tools that we create going to harm certain communities? Are they going to be inclusive of all communities? Those are the kinds of things the companies need to ask themselves, and Microsoft is very much doing that. As I said, we also have called for laws to regulate, for instance, facial recognition, because we see that facial recognition is a very, very powerful AI tool, and we think that it's important that society understands what the guardrails are around facial recognition, and frankly, that there are guardrails around that a very important and potentially, actually it is a powerful and potentially harmful technology. And so Washington State, although it did not pass a broad privacy law, it did pass a very important law dealing with facial recognition, one that I highly recommend that everyone look at because of, in some ways it has some very innovative pieces to it, including a requirement that companies that provide facial recognition technologies have to open up their APIs, their code, so that third parties can test the technology. So it's one thing for Microsoft to understand or to believe that its technology is not biased and that it is fair, but it's another thing to subject that technology to testing. And that's what's going to be deeply important as we go forward, that we allow through transparency, through opening up our technology, we allow people to examine it so that it can become more, Chris, to our shared value, it can become trusted. That's very important. So
let me ask for short answers on a, because we need to go to some of our questions, and I want to bundle some of our or the numerous questions that we've gotten online, several that deal with sort of the ecosystems of information sharing and the ways that, you know, information that comes to one party gets elsewhere. And one is data brokers. What do we do about data brokers? And, you know, also, how do you strike the right balance between, controllers, processors, service providers, third parties, is the language and that we use and the Senate bills use. What are the mechanisms to do that? And Chris, let me start with you on that one, if I could.
Sure. Julie talked about purpose limitation, limiting how much data is collected, but certainly, I think that's a big part of it. But when you get to these data brokers, they are collecting information from so many different locations, so many different companies, and processing it. And so I think the standards around data use and data sharing just needs to be higher on those entities. I think that's one of the values of your framework. I think has us interested is you've set different standards or different levels of duties depending on the actions and even the size in some ways of the entity. A small nonprofit, like public knowledge, certainly collects some information. We're getting emails from folks who want to follow our policies, but we don't have nearly the stringent rule. We wouldn't have nearly the stringent rules in your framework as a data broker or someone who's doing algorithmic decision-making with AI. And I think that's appropriate. So I think it starts there.
Christine, were you to see the FTC pick up on its prior work on data brokers?
So it is a topic that is of significant interest to me. I have had talks with various stakeholders about those issues, and I think it goes back to accountability. Chris mentioned data brokers are getting information from a wide variety of sources. What we see in your duty of care and duty of loyalty, but I think can also be encompassed in an obligation for accountability, is a recognition that businesses need to bear some of the burden, if not much of the burden, of being responsible for the way that they use and share data. And if they are sharing data, there are purpose limitations, and they also need to they need to engage in vendor management. They need to think about risk assessments. If they share certain data with certain parties, what can happen with that? And what we see now is that information can be shared with essentially no safeguards with a third party, and then that third party can share it with umpteen other third parties. And we end up with data brokers who are collecting lists of Alzheimer's patients to sell to scam artists as sucker lists. And it is, it's repulsive. And so I think implementing some kind of regime, I call it accountability, different frameworks call it different labels, would go a long way toward helping ensure that sharing of data is undertaken with accountability and with purpose limitations, the importance of which both Julie and Chris have talked about.
And Julie, quickly, I mean, Microsoft is a service provider, a covered entity, a third party, all of the above. How do you balance, you know, what's the right balance in those roles?
It's really just important to recognize that with respect to companies that play different roles, that their responsibilities should be different, but they also all need to work together, that there are responsibilities that need to be placed on all companies. And with respect to data brokers, I can't not answer that question because it's an issue that I've been working on for many, many years. When I was a commissioner, I called for an initiative called Reclaim Your Name. We also came out with our data broker report, as everyone's talked about. Here's the fundamental problem with data brokers. We absolutely need to have accountability provisions. We need to have a duty of care, duty of loyalty. All that is important. But the fundamental problem is people don't know anything about these entities that are collecting data about them and using data and processing it and creating profiles behind the scenes. There are solutions to this. We can bring this to a fore. We can have the FTC create a portal, and all data brokers have to register, and they have to let people know what data they have about them. So people can see, gosh, I'm being profiled as a tax deadbeat, or I'm being profiled as a dog lover, and I hate dogs. I love cats. I don't like that. I mean, we need to make this entire ecosystem of data collection that happens behind the scenes, it needs to come out from the shadows, and it needs to be public, and the FTC has a critical role to play in this.
Let me take one of our questions. Let me take one of our questions online as sort of a point of departure for your wrap-up remarks. And the question is, you know, Kim, is any comprehensive bill in this term possible? And if not, you know, how does the debate today provide a foundation for future talks in the next Congress? For the kinds of compromises that it will take. So you get the last words. Let's do this in alphabetical order. So about a minute apiece. Julie, you start.
Sure. I think I'm an optimist. Anything's possible. I think we have to recognize the table is round. It is not, there are not two sides. And in that round table, people have to sit at the center. And when people sit at the center and we're focused on what people need, we will be able to come to solutions. I love something Chris said. In addition to my lessons that I outlined from Washington State, Chris also mentioned a very important fourth lesson. We don't need to be perfect the first time out. We need to recognize that privacy is a journey, and that what we need to do is get good provisions in place and then come back, see how they've worked, and then improve them. Those are the things that I think will get us over the finish line.
Chris?
I agree with that. I think there's another piece to it. While knowing that there's more work to do beyond an initial comprehensive privacy bill, I think it's important that that bill sets up a framework and a structure that allows us to do that harder work beyond that initial bill. And so I think that starts with the authority and the power of the agency, whether it's the FTC or a new agency, whoever's given that power and authority to protect privacy has to have ongoing work to do and the ability to and the wide-ranging authority to do it. This includes harmonizing privacy laws across different regimes. There are multiple agencies that have authority over privacy for sector-specific reasons, and those are important reasons. We need to maintain those at those agencies, but they need to be able to work in concert with FTC rules. And similarly, you set up in your proposal, Cam, a reevaluation of preemption. I'm not a fan of preemption. I think we lose, some of the innovation at the state level that is so important. I think your proposal learned lessons from some state bills. You have concepts in there that were in some state bills, and we can continue to learn in the future, whether it's from Washington State's facial recognition protections or new technology biometric protections that are coming out of Illinois. We don't want to lose that opportunity to improve laws at the federal level because they haven't been tested in the states. And so I think it is an ongoing process, but we have to have the authority, both at the state and the federal level, to continue to improve the law and to strengthen protections where necessary.
Christine, you get the last word.
Thank you. So I heartily agree that we cannot let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. Shortly after I was sworn in, I attended a privacy and data security event at which a company said, I would take one crappy federal privacy law over 50 different state laws. And it is very hard for businesses to invest. It is very difficult for businesses to innovate without predictability and certainty. And it's very important for consumers to understand, as Julie said, how their information is collected and used. And if there are 50 different state laws, because nature abhors a vacuum and Congress doesn't give us federal privacy legislation, that's a lot of confusion for consumers. And so I think we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. One other quote that I would close with: Travis LeBlanc is a member of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Board that works with government agencies on privacy and civil liberties issues. He wrote a letter to Acting Secretary Wolf earlier this week, and he said the pandemic should not be viewed as a hall pass to run roughshod over privacy and civil liberties. I completely agree with that. And the issues that we're seeing now, the Senate is debating whether we can have warrantless searches for internet searches. And so we're seeing GPS data, health data, internet searches, and a variety of other very sensitive information being jeopardized given the twin issues that we are grappling with now, both the pandemic and the national unrest. And so now is the time for Congress to act and to provide the certainty and the guardrails for dealing with all of these very sticky issues. And so I am an eternal optimist like Julie. I will continue pushing because I do believe that it can be done. I would love to see Congress rise to the occasion and get it done.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Christine Wilson, Chris Lewis, and Julie Brill. I appreciate your being here today to join this discussion and hope our discussion today, the report, which is now available online, will help to provide a path forward. So thank you, everybody, for attending. And this video will be posted probably tomorrow on the Brookings website. Thank you and goodbye.